Welcome to the Master Your Mix podcast, helping engineers, producers, and artists create professional recordings and mixes, even from home. I'm your host, Mike Indovina. Let's get started. Welcome to the Master Your Mix podcast. My name is Mike Indovina, and thank you for hanging out with me today. Today, my guest is Will Beasley. And if you're not familiar with Will is a recording and mixing engineer who has worked with a bunch of amazing artists such as The Dangerous Summer, Turnstile, Asking Alexandria, Amorosa, and so many more. And in today's conversation, we have a really great chat all about his entire production process. And specifically, we talk a lot about the idea of creating space for instruments within your mix and how you can go about shaping your sounds in terms of their sustain, how much ring you have, how much gain you have on your amps, all that kind of stuff, so that ultimately you can make your tracks sound clear with each other, but yet still have a mix that feels big, full, and wide. And it goes beyond just getting the right tones. The way you choose to work, the order that you do things in, that can also have a big impact in terms of how clear your mix ends up. So we talk about the idea of being strategic with what order you work in so that things like your vocals, for example, can have a ton of clarity, because your vocals are obviously such an important part of your mix. It's the thing that people resonate with. Yet so many people leave their vocals as an afterthought. But Will has a bit of a different approach. So we cover that in this episode here today, too. And then we also get into things like getting the right guitar tones, getting big drum sounds. If you've listened to any of Will's mixes, you can tell that he puts a lot of care into getting the right tones on guitars so that things like your drums and your vocals can truly breathe in the mix. So yeah, we get into all of his process, and I think that there's a lot of great stuff that he shares with you today. So with that said, let's just jump right into today's episode. Will Beasley, thank you so much for being on the Master Your Mix podcast. How's it going, man?
Hey, how's it going? Thanks so much for having me.
Of course. For people who might not be familiar with you, can you give us a little background on who you are, what you do, and ultimately how you got into everything you're working on these days?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I'm a producer, mixer, engineer. I'm out in Richmond, Virginia right now. And I've been recording since I was like 16. And it's just pretty much all I've ever wanted to do is make music and record and, you know, be a part of music. And this was just kind of the path that, you know, everything took. You know, I played in bands when I was younger and stuff, and I am in a band right now still. We're called Wild Truth, and yeah, so I started out really doing YouTube covers, funny enough, when I was like maybe 12, 13 years old, and I would just set up the camcorder and record, and then I'd see all these people on YouTube, and I'd be like, why does mine not sound like that? Like, why does theirs sound so good? And then I started learning about, oh, they're using actual microphones and, like, you know, miking up their cav and stuff like that. And that just kind of started down a whole rabbit hole of, like, you know, just getting better quality audio, you know, every day. And that's basically a chase that I've been after since. So
love it. Yeah, I think you're the first person to come on and say that, like, YouTube was your start with the covers.
But, dude, yeah, I mean, yeah. Like I said, I was just like, man, it sounds so much clearer than me playing to this backing track on a camcorder. Like,
yeah, that's awesome. That's actually a really cool way to get into it, because, yeah, the world of video, it's like there's so much that can go into making video look good and sound good. And so it's a deep rabbit hole when you get into that world, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I mean, then obviously that just went into, like, you know, recording bands and my friends' bands. And then, you know, they were happy with their product. And then so they told their friends, and I recorded their friends' band, and, you know, it's just nice. It just kind of spiraled from there. So
I love it. So was your goal, like, when you got into it, for, like, it sounded like you were doing the YouTube thing, was your goal to be like a YouTuber? Like, was that the reason why? Obviously you got into it because of that, but, like, were you like, once I know how to record, I'm just gonna be a YouTuber and, like, push that? Or did, like, the band thing just become your thing now?
Yeah, no, I mean, being like a YouTuber, that definitely was never my thought at all. It was just, I grew up in a really small town, and it was just the only way that I could, like, kind of connect with people in the outside world with my music, you know what I mean? 'Cause no one in my town played music or anything like that. So it was just a way for me to be like, hey world, I play music, like let's connect, you know what I mean? And then I mean I did that for maybe like 2 years and then completely stopped that. And so
and then
I just started recording bands, and I fell in love with that. And after I graduated high school, I moved up to Baltimore, Maryland, and worked with a producer named Paul Levitt and Brian McTernan as well. And I interned at their studio, and that's just really kind of where I like cut my teeth, and really was, that's where it started to be like, oh, okay, like I want this to be like my career, you know what I mean? And learned so much while I was up there, and got a ton of experience just recording bands and, you know, working with projects with them as well. That was like a huge experience in my my upbringing, so to speak, is with audio.
That's amazing. So prior to that, was it all just like self-taught?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. That's cool.
Yeah. Just a lot of, lot of trial and error, and you know how it goes.
Totally. Yeah. Right on. So you got to work with Paul and Brian. What were some of the big lessons that you learned as a result of like working with those guys?
I mean, so much. They really taught me how to like properly mic a drum kit, and like how to, you know, I think the biggest thing I learned was just how meticulous you have to be to get the sound that you want. You know what I mean? And like, you know, the guitars need to be like really in tune and really tight, and like you can't skimp on any of that stuff. And that's how you get the, you know, the sound of your favorite records, is making sure that all the performances are so tight and so good and have vibe. And yeah, I learned a ton from them. So
yeah, I love that you focus on that. And like, cause there's a lot of people who, you know, especially in like the home recording world, when they're getting started, like they completely just rely on like editing or mixing to fix poor recordings. And so I like that you kind of word it as like, get the performance right, get like all that other stuff right first. Cause I agree with that method. I think that like you need to have that solid foundation to build on top of.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you can edit all day, but it's like an edited version of a bad performance is never, ever going to be a really, really solid performance that isn't edited. You know what I mean? Like there is no like replacement for great musicians.
Totally. Yeah. And it makes everyone's life easier if like, yeah, if you have to do less editing and you get a more realistic feel and all that kind of stuff, it just makes the whole product better in the end.
Totally. Yeah. And I mean, I feel like a lot, like you said, a lot of beginners, like they think about editing more so than the performance. And like, I find a lot of people wondering like, oh, why do my guitars not sound as huge as like this record or whatever? And a lot of the time it's because they're not that in tune and they're not that tight. Like, and it's like more so than the amp or the guitar or the mic or whatever was used. Like it's that guy's really fucking good at guitar and that's why it sounds that good. You know what I mean? Like a lot of times I feel like you throw SM57 up in front of it and it's a really great guitar player. And like, I mean, don't get me wrong, a great guitar and amp and, you know, miking setup and everything makes a huge difference. But I think that those things are not as important as getting the right performance.
For sure. So then when you're starting on a project with a band, like how much emphasis do you put on like the pre-production side of things to prepare a band for the studio?
I mean, so it really depends on the band. Because some bands are incredibly prepared already, where it's like, you know, they might have a guy in the band who does their demos and stuff like that. And, you know, they have everything mapped out to like, hey, we want a bass drop right here. You know, we want reverse cymbals here. Like everything's very mapped out. But, you know, a lot of times it's, if I have a band that, you know, isn't like super prepared to that level, which sometimes I kind of prefer because it just leaves a lot more up to, you know, a lot more up to experimentation and things like that, and like kind of letting things flow naturally. But yeah, I put a pretty good emphasis on pre-pro, and just making sure that like everyone knows what they're going to play and how the, you know, how the songs are going to go. And I really do like to have like some pretty solid demos before we like start tracking for real, so to speak.
Yeah. And are those demos that you'll just make during that pre-pro stage, like just live off the floor kind of things?
Yep, exactly. Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, I think that's really helpful for people because yeah, I think a lot of people, one thing I've definitely found with a lot of musicians, especially like amateurs, is like they're so used to playing and jamming in these big loud rooms, and they're not able to hear the little intricate details of everyone else in the room. And so it's only once it's recorded that they start to realize like, oh, wait a minute, you play that pattern, or like, you know, the...
No, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. It's the classic, like, well, it sounded good at practice, you know, like that's...
Yeah,
that's the classic. It's like, well, you're in a 10 like storage unit, of course, like you don't know what everybody's doing, like
totally. Yeah, so it makes a lot of sense to do the demoing ahead of time. What are some other like common maybe like mistakes that you would say you see people making before entering the studio or like entering that pre-pro stage, like what, whether it's like with their arrangements or performance or what, like what are some of the things that you've noticed that you have to kind of call bands out on sometimes?
I think more so than anything is people not having vocals ready, because a lot of bands will come in with like, oh, we've got, you know, 10 songs or whatever, but none of them have vocals. And it's like, well, I mean, that is arguably the most important part of the picture. Like, and that can change so many things. Like, it's really hard. Like, I'm very wary about like, you know, cutting up and restructuring a song if there's not vocals there, because it's like this part might feel like a little empty or whatever when the vocal's not there, but then you put the vocal there and it's like, oh wow, yeah, it all makes sense. And like that emptiness is great because it's bringing the vocal forward. Like, so it, and I see a lot of people also when they're demoing and not thinking about the vocal, they start adding and adding and adding because they're like in their mind, their subconscious is saying something's missing. So I have to like keep adding a lead. And like, I by the time you get it, you know, they're done with the demo, there's like 4 or 5 leads over this one part. And it's like, okay, now we try to go to put the vocal and there's no space for it. And I think that a lot of times that subconscious, I need to keep adding, is like, yeah, you need to add the vocal, you know, that's, again, it's the arguably the most important part of the picture. So
totally. Yeah, I agree with that. And I think that like, yeah, vocals can mess with so much in an arrangement. Like it's going to determine like rhythms and energy and like, you know, how much you should build up on certain things. Like there's so much that can be controlled by the dynamic and the power and the timing and all that stuff of the vocal. So you can't treat it as an afterthought. Like, you know, it is a song in many ways. Like nobody's singing the drum part. Everyone's singing the vocal line, right?
Totally. Yeah. Yeah. And I mean, I feel like a lot of like, again, like lead guitars and stuff, I feel like I like to do things where like, you know, the vocal and the guitar or bass or whatever, like a call and response between the two. And like, you can really use the main melody of the vocal to your advantage to figure out, okay, well, he sings there, so I'm going to back off a little bit here. But then when he's not singing, you know, I can do my response to his vocal that he just sang, and, you know, really filling the space and things like that. So,
yeah, it is kind of funny that like you kind of mentioned both of those extremes of like the people that have no vocals versus the people who just like add and add and add, you know? I think that's the other side of it too, is that like just as much as there's the people that have not finished their songs, there's the people that have done way too much, and it's finding that that balance of how to strip it back, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, because again, things can be almost like too planned out in a way where it's like there's no room up for, you know, just creativity of how it's going to sound when you get in this different environment and things like that. So
like what kind of things do you do then? Let's say a band sends you something where, you know, they've demoed it themselves and they've just thrown way too much at it and it's just too busy. Like, how do you go about that process of stripping it down without potentially like offending the band or, you know, or just making sure that you've got the song in its absolute best form.
Yeah. I mean, so once I get the song and they're like, hey, this is my demo, like let's make it the best. Then I just kind of tell the band like, hey, I'm going to say whatever I feel and whatever I think. And like, at the end of the day, it's your song. So like, if you don't like my ideas, then, you know, it's your song. You can tell me no. Like you can say, hey, I don't like that idea. Like we love this part, but I just say, hey, I'm going to say every single thought that comes to my mind. And like, it has nothing to do with, I don't care who played the part. I don't care how much you love the part. Like if I feel like in that moment, hey, this part is not doing it or it's taking away from something else, then, you know, I'm going to voice my opinion or else I'm doing a disservice to the band, you know?
Totally. Yeah. It all has to be serving the song at all times and be thinking about, you know, what makes the song the best and put aside egos. And everyone's got to realize, like, at the end of the day, we're making the song and that's it. It's not about showing off how good we are as individuals, that kind of thing. I like that idea of just focusing on that. And I could be wrong, but I think I heard you say in another interview that occasionally you would like mute tracks in a mix just to see if the band even notices that you've muted it. I don't know if you can comment on that.
Yeah, totally. Totally. Yeah. I've done that before too. Like where, you know, if you mute something and then play it back and nobody notices, it probably didn't need to be there, you know? And like, it's just, I think that especially now that everyone has access to record themselves in infinite tracks, you know, it's like, I find a lot of people just adding so much that just clouds what is really important about the song. And it's like, all it's doing is just making it so that, I mean, further down the line, like when you get to a mix, it's like, if I have, you know, 10 tracks in a song, I can make every single one of those tracks like huge and really have their own personality and their own presence. But if, you know, we have 100 tracks, like something's got to give, like I'm going to have to make a lot of these things smaller and like make space for these 100 tracks and like these like 10 synth parts or whatever, you know what I mean? So it's like, I really think that that's something that is sometimes lost, is just how when you add so much, you just, again, it's something's got to give. Like every single thing can't be huge and sound like the biggest thing ever. It's like you got to have the perspective of some things have to sound small and some things have to take the forefront. And like, yeah, I just personally like a lot of my favorite records have arrangements that are for the most part guitar, bass, drums, vocal, and like every single one of those elements has their own personality and just sounds huge. And you can really like feel the space, but like around the instrument, as opposed to, you know, every single thing, every single frequency range is just like filled up and it almost starts to become like white noise in a way, you know, like to me at least.
Yeah.
Where I'm starting to lose the importance of like the melodic parts of the arrangement, you know?
Totally. Yeah, I like what you said there about like creating space around the instrument. And I think that, you know, it's funny you say that because like when I listen to your mixes, one of the things that really stands out to me is like, I think you do a great job of getting guitar tones. I think there's so many other people I think there's so many people that like create these like walls of guitar that are just like super fuzzed out. They're just like too dense. But with your tracks, I think you do a great job of getting the size and like your guitars feel big in a mix and they feel wide and they feel full, but without being too dense or too fizzy or too like consuming of other instruments. You know, and so I was curious to know, like, when it comes to getting great guitar tones, like, what's your typical process like there in terms of creating that space around the other instruments?
Yeah, so I really appreciate you saying that. That is something that I think about a lot, is like with guitars specifically, is I mean, another thing is like you don't have to double track every single part. And that's something that, like, within the past, even within the past, like, I don't know, 5-6 years that I've really realized and taken hold of, and I think has made my productions and mixes, like, a lot better, is that, like, again, not every single thing has to be double tracked, and, like, not every single thing has to be, you know, just doesn't really have to be stereo all the time. Because then when, say, you hit the chorus and then you do add in those stereo double track big guitars, it makes it feel even bigger. Again, it's just about the thing where, like, sometimes things, you need to make things small so that when the big part of the song and the dynamic of the song jumps up, it feels even bigger. And that's kind of a lot of the illusion with, like, when I do guitars and stuff like that is, you know, the verse a lot of times will be, I'll even, like, automate and pan the guitars a little more center in the verses and in smaller parts, and then hit the chorus and they're, you know, hard left and right. And it just gives this illusion that it gets really wide and, like, but it's really that the other part is smaller.
Yeah, I like that. Like, creating that contrast, that's a really cool approach. And I also like you touched on, like, automating the width of a track too, because I think that that's a really underutilized thing that people forget about in their mixes. As far as, like, double tracking, I know you were talking, like, you were saying that not everything has to be double tracked, obviously. But when you do double track, you know, going back to what I was saying about the width with your tracks, how do you go about doing that? Are you double tracking? Like, are your double tracks, like, literally, like, two takes of the exact same setup, or do you switch up the left and right to help you get that width? Like, what does that look like for you in your process?
Yeah, usually when I do double track things, it'll be something in the setup is different, whether it's the guitar or the amp, or maybe a slightly different mic position or a slightly different EQ. Because, yeah, that really does help the width as well, is just having something be different on both sides, you know, different from each other on the side. So most of the time it's a different amp. And sometimes it'll be a guitar, you know, sometimes it's nice to have, like, a single coil on one side and then a humbucker on the other side. It really just depends on the song too.
Yeah. Yeah. That's cool. And interesting that you say that. And I think it makes a lot of sense because, yeah, if you just, like, completely doubled up the exact same thing, it could very easily make that dense feel because it's just like you're not hearing any difference really. Whereas when you do have, like, something maybe a little brighter, something a little cleaner or something like that, it does create that movement between the two parts and the two sides of the speakers. So it makes a lot of sense to me.
Totally. Yeah. And yeah, I mean, I think that, like, just really thinking about every element in your mix as a character with its own personality, like, in the story, you know, I think that really helps to, again, just give more personality to the song as a whole, because you've got these characters with a different story, so to speak, within the mix. And I think that it really just helps pull things out and just be heard, you know?
Totally. As far as, like, your typical, like, mic setup, what does that look like for you?
Yeah, so, I mean, I've tried the multi-miking, you know, a 121 and a 57, or 421 and a 57, all that. And I really have just gotten to a point where I've ended up muting that when I get to the mix so much that I don't even try anymore. I literally am just, I'm, like, so simple with it, just 57, boom, done.
Love it. I love that. And it's funny, like, I feel like the more people I talk to you on this podcast, like, there's so many people that say the same thing where it's like, yeah, they just would overcomplicate the setup, add more mics than they need. And then it just always comes back down to that 57.
Totally. And I mean, the different mics can come in handy for, like, maybe different parts or something like that. But a lot of times when it's the two mic thing, I don't know, for me, just something sounds smaller to me when you start adding in these other mics. Like, I don't know if it's phasing or what, but it's just like, and I mean, I've definitely been, like, really analytical about getting, you know, this is all the phase on every mic is perfect, you know what I mean? I can look at it and see, but still there's just something that I don't know what, I have no idea why, but just to me it always ends up sounding smaller than when I just mute those and turn the 57 up a little more.
For sure. I get that for sure. And I also think, too, the other habit that a lot of people, or the tendency that a lot of people would have, is if they do the two mic technique, they feel like they need to have both mics. So like then it'll end up getting like too dense, because they'll throw like way too much of the Ruben mic in there just to like say they used it, or like, because that's the thing they think they're supposed to do, right? So
Something, totally.
Something to that, just simplicity. As far as like amp settings go, do you ever blend amps or anything like that? Like, I feel like when I listen to your tracks, I can hear like a lot of cleanliness in the notes, but I still hear enough of that like dirt underneath it to feel full.
Yeah, no, I mean, blending amps, not so much. I really just keep things simple, man. Like, it's a lot of my guitar tones are my JMP, just literally turned all the way up, the 57 in front of it. I mean, it's worked since the '70s, so I mean, works for me. Like, every time I've like tried to do any like, you know, some fancy thing that some guy said is the best thing ever, every single time I try, I'm like, when again I put my ego aside and I'm like, okay, truly, what is working better in this mix right now? It is always just the simplest thing.
Yeah, I love that. Yeah, it's so easy to overcomplicate, especially with digital, where you can just like layer all your tracks and all that stuff like we were just talking about. Yeah, it makes a lot of sense. Well, that's cool. I was very curious to learn more about your guitar process. And another thing that really stands out to me with your tracks too is like your drum production. I think you do a great job of like getting awesome drum tones, and in particular snare sounds. And I've talked about this on the podcast before. Thanks. I'm a drummer, so like for me, snare sounds are like the hardest thing in the world to get. Like, I just feel like there's something about them that is like very elusive to me, like to get that perfect sound. But I think you do a great job of getting like really big, beefy snares. And I'm curious to know more about that too. Like, what's your typical go-to approach for getting snares?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that the snare sound, again, just like I was saying before with, performances, it starts with the drummer. It all starts with the drummer and how the drummer hits 100%. And then, I mean, I'd say the snare itself and the tuning. I really like to use a Black Beauty or my Tama Bell Brass, either one of those. I mean, just depending on the song, those are 99.99% of the time going to be the snares on my records.
Those are kind of like the two big, like, if you have those snares in your arsenal, you're pretty much set.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I have some other stuff where it's like, you know, if we need like a really weird indie vibe or something like that, but more often than not, Rock Band, it's going to be one of those two.
Yeah.
I mean, I think tuning is one of the biggest things. It's just like listening to the song and making sure that the ring of your snare is not, you know, super annoying with the key of the song. And like, do we need a fat snare? Or should we tune a little lower? Do we need a lot of crack out of the snare? We tune it higher. I also think that room mics are a huge, huge thing with the snare sound. And not choking your snare too much to where there is no resonance. Like a lot of times if I'm listening to drums like by themselves, I always know I'm in the right realm of where I want to be in the end. If I solo out my drums and the snare is like a little too ringy, I'm like, oh, there's just a little too much ring there. That's how I know I'm like, okay, it's probably good, because, you know, you start stacking guitars and stuff over it and that's all going to go away. But if you don't have that ring, then it's just going to sound like a pillow.
Yep, I totally agree with that. I think that, yeah, ring is one of those things that so many people associate as this bad thing. And yeah, in isolation, it sounds weird, but it's also one of those things that adds a lot of the sustain to your drum and it makes it feel bigger than just this like initial stick attack hit. You know, it does give it all that body. So I'm glad that you bring that up, because it's one of those things that I think a lot of people do as a mistake, is like they filter out all that stuff. And then afterwards they're like, oh, why does everything sound so weak and thin? So you killed the body, right? So.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I mean, if the drum is supposed to resonate, that's what it does. And again, with the tuning, that's how you really tame it and get it into a place where it's going to be pleasing with the song. And like, again, if the snare is ringing at a note that's like in key with the song, then it's just going to be musical with it. And it's going to, you're not going to think of it as like, I feel like the St. Anger snare really like, people are so scared of like their snare sounding like that. You know what I mean? Like, I actually kind of like that snare, to be honest.
It's grown on me.
I
think it's right? Grown on me. Yeah, I've shit on it so many times, but it's grown on me now.
obviously, it's too much. But the principle is like, that's how you have character to your drum, is the ring. You know what I mean? That is the character of the drum.
Totally. And I think why that snare works is because of the arrangements. Like, there's not a lot of like intricate detail work that the snare is getting in the way of. Like, there's space between a lot of the notes. So like, that ring actually works because it's filling in gaps in those productions. So that's why it works. You know, if it was like a prog metal thing, then it would be a totally different story.
Yeah, totally. And that's actually a really great point too, is like, you know, really listen to the tempo of the song and what the drummer's playing, and can you blow up the room mics and make the sustain, you know, it's about filling that space. If the drummer's playing really spaced out notes, like you said, like, you know, I'm probably going to bring up the room mics and compress them harder and get more length to the hits than if it's a really fast song where, you know, there's a ton of double bass and like, you know, fast snare hits, blast beats, whatever. Then on that kind of thing, I'm going to be trying to contain that sustain so that it doesn't bleed over to each hit, you know, and make it messy.
Absolutely. Yeah. And another thing I was curious to know with your snares is like, do you ever use saturation on them to like get a little bit more weight out of them that way? Or is it all just in the tuning?
Yeah. A little bit of saturation. I actually use this plugin called Tapehead, very very old plugin, but
Massey, yeah.
But yeah, that's a really great one on the snare. I love that. And then EQ as well is a big, you know, is a very big part of that too. Just kind of boosting that low end, like, you know, 100, 200 hertz. That really gets the thump.
Yeah, and when you're adding something like Tapehead or adding any sort of saturation, like, what are you ultimately listening for? What's your goal with adding that?
For me, it's I'm really more so listening to the transients than anything, and I kind of just turn it to where I feel like it's like squashing the transient a little too much, and kind of cutting it off a little too much, and then I go to the spot where it's not too piercing, but it still is fat, you know, you got to find the sweet spot in it and the transient.
Yeah, I totally agree with that. I can't remember which guest I had on the podcast that was describing that same sort of process. And I think they said that's like what John Feldman uses on a lot of his productions to get those like big kind of ringy snares. It's like, you know, crank the knee free too much, back it off enough that you get that transient still, but like you still have all the fatness of it, right?
Exactly. Yeah. And that's pretty much how I dial almost anything, is go too far, bring it back a hair. You know, that's usually the sweet spot for me.
It's a technique that kind of works. It works for finding frequencies with EQ and like, you know, how much to cut or boost and all that kind of stuff. So in saturation, yeah, it's a pretty useful technique.
Yeah, totally.
I think part of that too is like, it just, sometimes you have to go extreme so your ear can just like hear how obvious that sound is. And then when you start dialing it in, you start to really notice like how much you're dialing it back. And like the subtleties of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. You got to kind of like take the car to its breaking point, see what it can do. You know what I mean? And then you back off of here, and that's where you're cruising, you know?
Totally. Yeah. Well, you were talking about we were talking about like snares and ambience and, you know, filling in space between notes and stuff like that. And another thing that I feel like I notice when I listen to your mixes, you can correct me if I'm wrong here, but I feel like one thing I've noticed is that you tend to you'll frequently mess around with like the ambience of the track throughout the song. So like of an instrument throughout the song. So for example, like drums, I feel like sometimes in a chorus, I might hear more roominess, like I may hear more of like a bigger monstrous sound, and then a verse might feel a little bit tighter, that kind of thing. Is that something?
Absolutely.
I'm not making that up. So I'm curious to know more about that process and like how you approach, you know, when to blow something up and go really big with it, when to go small with it. What's that look like for you?
Yeah, no, that I do a lot of that, actually. And it's mostly, exactly like you said, the chorus. I take my room mics and really just blow them up as much as I possibly can usually. And then in the verse, back them off because like I was saying earlier, it's just that, again, it's just like, it's a way to create this illusion that things are bigger than they are in a way. And when you have the verse a little tighter and then you bring in the super, you know, the super compressed room mics that are huge, it really just takes it into a place where you're like, oh wow, this sounds like so much bigger now than if you were to have it compressed the whole time. You know what I mean? So, mm-hmm. So yeah, I definitely do a lot of that where, like, you know, in the bigger dynamic of the song, I'm going to try to make things bigger. And I think it's really all just like, it all starts from songwriting where, you know, you can listen to a song and hear, hey, the dynamic at this part is supposed to be a little lower. And then when you get to the mix phase, you're really just, you know, trying to take advantage of all that and push it even further. You know what I mean? Like make the small parts even smaller, make the big parts even bigger. So.
Absolutely. No, I think that's a really good point that you have to consider it in that arrangement stage. Cause time and time again, like I feel like I hear mixes from students of mine where it's like, it'll be the same instrumentation throughout the entire song. And you could feel like you want the choruses to feel bigger, but they're not there. And sometimes people just like bump up the volume of their master output. And like, it's like, yeah, that helps. That can make your mix feel a little bit bigger. But sometimes there's that other stuff that you need to just bring in to change it all up and make it way more blown out and way more obvious. Right.
Totally. Yeah. And I mean, I really feel like that was kind of an eye-opening thing for me when I started to do things like that was, you know, I always heard a lot of people say, you know, like, oh, you got to make the mix move. You got to make it move. Like, and I never really knew what that meant. And then, you know, just really experimenting with, okay, well, let me try to change scenes in the chorus, like really change the drum scene in the chorus and like really make it even like if you soloed out the drum tracks on some of my songs, like, you would maybe be shocked when you go from verse to chorus. It's like you solo out the chorus drums, you're like, holy shit, it's like you have that much room going on. Like that it sounds sometimes crazy on its own, but you put all the other stuff on there and it's like, if it all kind of grows like together, it doesn't seem as drastic, but you know, sold out, sometimes it is like pretty drastic between like verse and chorus.
Yeah. So then how do you go about managing adding all of that extra room ambience? Like how do you go about doing it in a way that it's not making the mix sound like super muddy? Cause sometimes like room mics, you know, if they're far away from a drum kit or something like that, you get a lot of that low rumble. What's your approach to making sure that those sound clean and it doesn't make the mix like get swallowed up?
Yeah. And that's really the hardest part of it too, is like when you are adding this ambience, like you said, you're kind of adding a lot of mud to stuff, and you really got to pay attention to the low mids in the room mics, especially I've found. It's really just a matter of like, also it only works if the drummer's playing a certain thing, you know what I mean? Like, because again, if he's playing really spaced out notes, then we can add a ton of ambience. But if it's, you know, fast song and things are going really fast, then it's all the mud is just going to continue to build. And, I'd say paying attention to the low mids a lot is very helpful.
No, I think that's exactly it. And, you know, you're right. Like when it comes to tempo plays such a big role in determining how long a snare can be or whatever it can be. You know, you need to fill in that gap, but you want it to be in time with the song. And, you know, I've definitely heard people make that mistake before where it's like, you know, a skate punk song or something like that. And then they've got these like 2.5 second reverb times all over the snare. And it's like, of course it's going to get muddy. There's not 2.5 seconds between notes, you know, like,
yeah,
you have to make it tight and make it lock in. And when you fill in the gaps between each note properly, then it can still feel full, but without it having all that mud. So bring that up. Yeah. So as far as that ambience thing goes, you talked about like room mics. I'm assuming from the sounds of it, it sounds like you like to record with a lot of room mics or at least some to have like all of that ambience. Do you prefer room mics over having like, or like over adding like reverb and post?
Yeah, I don't use a lot of like straight up like reverb plugins and stuff like that. I mean, on vocals, but as far as drums go, I can't remember the last time I actually added like a true reverb to the drums. I'm definitely more of like use room mics. And I also have a lot of, I think a big trick with being able to like over compress like room sounds in a way is I use these room samples that I have. And so there's no cymbals in them at all. And I mean, I guess if you look at it, technically that is sort of like a reverb, but it's not like a reverb plugin, you know, it's sounds from that I've recorded. And when you take the cymbals, when you're able to just have the, you know, kick and snare room, you don't have to worry about compressing and then the cymbals getting super washy and crazy. So that's definitely a big thing to be able to like blow the room sound up.
I like that. And I'm curious to know, like, why do you prefer to use room samples as opposed to, you know, maybe just sending your snare sample to a reverb or something like that?
It's just never sounded as natural to me as when it just doesn't sound right to me for some reason. Like, it just always sounds a little like manufactured and like not what I picture when I, you know, when I hear the sound in my head. And I mean, maybe part of it too is just like, I know, you know, there's thousands or millions of people with this reverb plugin, but no one has this sound that I'm using right now. And so it's automatically unique to me and unique to the record.
Fair. Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah, it is very like, I feel like when I hear certain drum sounds, I can immediately pick out like, oh yeah, they use this plugin, or like, you know, it's the Logic stock drummer or something like that, you know? Like,
totally, yeah.
Certain notes, like I've heard them so many times.
Yeah, how many times have you heard the Superior drummer hi-hat? You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
It's like I hear a lot of songs and it immediately just, and I know that's just being like close to production and stuff, where like, you know, most people probably wouldn't,
not at all,
pick that thing out. But when I hear it, it just immediately it just turns off something in my brain. I don't know what it is, but yeah, I really value like unique sounds and unique things. I think that more so than, you know, things being the most pristine or the, you know, the clearest, whatever. Like, I feel like unique sounds and vibey sounds make the biggest difference and make records that, you know, stand the test of time, really.
For sure. Yeah, I agree with all of that. I'm curious to know, like, so we've obviously talked about your production style and, you know, as far and your engineering approach, but what happens when you get a track to mix that maybe you weren't involved in the like the recording part of it? You know, what's your mindset going into those kinds of mixes and like, you know, where do you typically start with those?
So I mostly start with gain staging and just kind of getting things set in my template how I want them to be, you know, and listen to the sounds. That's a big thing. I feel like a lot of people just immediately start triggering the drums and immediately start doing all these, you know, adding the amp sim that they always add. But it's like, again, back to the uniqueness factor, like hopefully these people who are sending you their track, they took the time to, you know, create and sculpt a sound that felt good to them and good for the song. And so, you know, you'd listen to it. And obviously, if I feel like I need to trigger the drums or whatever, then I'll do that. But I think the first step is listen to what is presented. And, you know, I just start having a million things in my head popping off of like, oh, I love the sound of this snare. The kick drum could be bigger, you know, whatever. And so I just kind of one by one, all those things in my head just take care of them. So, first things first, just listen to it. And are the sounds that they got working? If they are, then great. Let's just take them a step further. If they're not working, then, you know, we'll figure out how to make it work, whether that's, you know, adding drum samples or, you know, reamping, whatever.
Yeah. You'd mentioned you have a template. I'm assuming that based on what you just said, like your template doesn't really have like a whole bunch of like preloaded settings in there that would affect the sound like when you're first listening to it, right?
No, yeah. When I say template is very loose in the way that I'm saying it's more so like I have a bus compressor on the master bus and I know how hard that needs to be hitting, you know, and, you know, I have a tape saturation on my master bus. And if that's, it's just like, okay, let me get it to where this isn't, you know, completely crushing it and ruining it, or it's not doing anything at all. You know what I'm saying? So yeah. It's really more so just like, I have a few, like I have a drum bus, similar kind of thing where it's just like, more so as far as like the first steps, more so things where like I can know that I'm in a consistent place, a consistent starting place every time. So
yeah, it makes sense. It's getting rid of a lot of like the boring setup stuff and just getting you up and running quicker.
Exactly. Yeah. And I really don't do like as far as like EQ in a template, like I have EQ plugins like loaded up, but they're not doing anything. Because you know that's really gonna be song by song, track by track, what is needed there, you know?
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And then as far as once you've listened to it and it sounds like you kind of create this like mental checklist of all the things that you want to tackle, do you have like a specific order of instruments or whatever that you'd like to work in? Like or does it kind of just go based on like whatever you think is the most important thing first?
Yeah, so I mostly start with the drums, usually. Usually the drums, and then I really like to get the low end like as good as I can at first. And because I just feel like everything kind of builds upon that. Once you get the low end right, you know, then you can kind of start moving into more melodic things like the vocals and the guitars and things like that. One thing I've been doing semi-recently is actually, so I used to do like, you know, work on the drums, get that right, get the bass right, then move to guitars and then get the vocal sitting over top of that. Recently, I have started doing the vocal, you know, kind of putting my attention towards the vocal before the guitars. And I just feel like in the end, it's made my guitars better because they are kind of more, I'm more worrying, instead of worrying about, let's get the biggest guitar tone ever and then trying to fit the vocal in there. It's like, okay, so I've got the vocal sounding really good with the drums and bass. And then, you know, how can the guitars complement that and fill in the space that they need to fill?
Yeah, that's a pretty smart approach. And I can see the reasoning for it. Like, obviously the guitar is in that range where it's going to fight the vocal sometimes.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Those are the two things that are always fighting. Yeah.
Yeah. And if you just focus only on like getting your instrumental set up so that it sounds huge, then like, yeah, you're kind of trying to fit this vocal, which is supposed to be the most important part of your mix, into this other thing. And it makes you work that much harder to get that clarity. Maybe that's why I like a lot of your guitar tones, is because I feel like they don't step on the toes of the vocal. You know, a lot of that like fizziness that you typically hear on so many guitar tracks these days, it's like that I think feels really controlled in your mixes. And it makes sense that your vocal is kind of something you're paying more attention to, obviously, right?
Yeah. And I mean, to the fizziness comment, I mean, I really think a lot of that is probably that I usually track guitars with not as much gain as a lot of people would, I'd say. Like I definitely like go to a point where, again, it's sort of like the snare where it's like, oh, there's a little too much ring, but I know that when I put it with everything, it's going to be good. With the guitars, I take a similar approach of like, man, I wish I had a little more gain right now when I'm playing. And I'm like, that's going to be perfect. Because then when we start adding, you know, your bass probably has a little bit of grit in there. And, you know, you're probably going to double track some parts and things like that. Like all of that stuff's going to add up. And then you're going to, in the end, it's just going to result in more clarity. And you're still going to have like, for me, at least, I just feel like I've never run into the problem with guitars of like, oh, this doesn't have enough crunch or whatever. Like that's never the issue for me. The issue is usually, oh, this has too much fizz or too much whatever. You know what I'm saying? And like, so I think that I take an approach of backing off the gain a little bit to get that clarity, because to me, the crunch is gonna be there. Like,
yeah. Yeah, it's exactly like what we were talking about earlier with like, yeah, driving a preamp or something like that, going too far, backing it off. I'm in the same boat. I always feel when it comes to guitar is that like, if I'm uncomfortable with how clean the guitar is, that's the best tone for it, you know? I always have this like uncertainty of like, did I really go that clean? Shouldn't I put more gain? And then it ends up being the best thing ever after. So,
yep. Yeah, especially if you're doing a lot of like guitar layers, you know, it's like, okay, then you have a lead on top of it. It's like, okay, well, that lead's probably a little distorted too. And like, it just all kind of adds up. And I mean, it's also kind of like, I look at distortion and stuff like that is almost like getting your hair cut or something. It's like, you can always take more off, you know what I mean? But once, you know, you can't, once you cut it off, you can't put it back. It's like with the distortion, it's like, if you do too much, you're not going back.
Yeah.
You know, but if you don't do enough, we can always add a little more later in whatever way we need to, you know?
Totally. I mean, I'm bald, so I can't relate to that haircut comment. But no, I know what you mean by it. I know what you mean exactly. But yeah, it's definitely the thing. Like you can always add a little bit more gain in your mix if you need to. You can add a little bit, like, you know, throw like some sort of Tube Screamer overdrive pedal plug in on your track or something like that if you need more grit, you know. But when you have that like big wall of fizz and it's like a big sausage waveform, like you can't do anything with that, you know. You've painted yourself in the corner.
Yeah, and it just adds up and adds up, and it really can start eating a mix alive, really,
for sure. So then you know, with all this said, like, what in your opinion makes a great sounding mix?
Man, that's a good question. To me, in a mix, I just look for a great separation between instruments. I can understand what's going on, but simultaneously enough glue that everything gels together and feels good. And yeah, really just a mix that goes with the dynamics of the song. And like, again, like the big parts sound big, the small parts sound small, like, and whatever is supposed to be in the forefront, whatever melodic or percussive or whatever is the shining spotlight, like, it is in the spotlight, you know?
Absolutely. I think it's easy to sometimes say those kind of like descriptors when we're talking about like other songs that we're fans of. But when you're in the moment, sometimes it's hard to like see that for yourself if like you've achieved all of those things. So for you, like, how do you know when you're done with mix and that you've met the standards that you're expecting?
I usually am like referencing a lot of my favorite records. And when I, you know, and different per song, you know what I mean? Like whatever the song I'm working on, if I find something that is, I want that feeling of this mix that I've heard before. I do a lot of referencing back and forth towards the end where it's like, okay, if I'm getting the same feeling from my mix that I get when I listen to my favorite records, then I'm done, you know?
Makes sense. I'm curious to know, when it comes to references, do you typically have like kind of like one reference mix that's like your golden reference that you compare to, or do you listen to like multiple references for different elements of the song? Because that's one thing I feel like I hear a lot of my students say is like, oh, I like the guitar in this reference in this track here, and then I like the drums in this track here, and they're listening to all these different songs and trying to piece elements together. And I think that can sometimes be confusing to people when they're listening to multiple tracks, but I'm curious to know how you approach that.
Yeah, absolutely. And the referencing, you really have to kind of take like a grain of salt, because it's like, I mean, your guitars are not going to sound exactly like this, you know, this record's guitars. Like it's not the same guitar player, not the same guitar, not the same amp. You know what I mean? It's
totally.
And you're not trying to recreate it. You're trying to have something that brings you to a similar place. And I think that's mostly what is like when I'm referencing, it's literally more so just like, oh, I like this record's, you know, like you said, I like this record's guitars, or like I play my mix, listen to that. And it's like, oh, okay, well, my guitars aren't quite at, like my guitars are maybe a little too quiet, and that one, they really stick out. So it's like, okay, cool. I just need to turn my guitars up, and then done. Gotcha. That's it. It's like, I feel like you can really, really start chasing your tail and go down a rabbit hole with references. It's so easy to do. And so you really have to be kind of disciplined and like, you know, being confident. And this is my unique production right now. And it is going to sound different because it's supposed to. It's a different song.
That makes sense. And I also think it depends on like when you listen to reference tracks. Like at what point in the process are you comparing stuff? If you're in the tracking stage, like, yeah, you can try to chase tones a lot more. But if you're in the mix where everything's already kind of committed there, you're not going to be able to EQ a guitar to sound like another track and make it work very easy. You know, it's going to be much more of a challenge.
Yeah. And I'm usually more so referencing, like, for me, at least in the mix stage, more so like towards the end, where it's more so just a thing where like I have some references where I'm like, okay, I know that this is like a very bright mix. If my mix feels brighter than this mix, I'm too bright. And I have things that are like, oh, this mix is really, really low end heavy. And it's like kind of like a, like I said, it's like if I have more low end than this, that's too much. You know what I mean? So it's,
yeah,
I kind of have like ranges of things more so than like I'm trying to sound exactly like this.
Totally. Yeah. It's like you're using the references more as inspiration for like volume balance or overall frequency balance, not necessarily like all the little details that make up all of that.
Totally. Yeah.
Yeah. Right on, man. Cool. Well, this has been awesome. Like, it's been great learning more about your process. And I, you know, I agree with a lot of what you're talking about here in terms of just like creating space for other instruments in the mix and, you know, mapping all that stuff out and figuring out sustain on a drum or figuring out how clean a guitar should be. Like all that stuff, it all comes together to give your mixes the clarity that they have. So it's been great to learn more about this process. If people want to learn more about you, or maybe like even like follow you online or maybe even work with you, like what's the best way for them to do that?
Yeah, I mean, you can check me out on Instagram at @will_Beasley. Email willbeasleyrecording@gmail.com. Yeah, all the socials. So that's how.
Right on, man. Awesome. Well, thanks again for doing this. I really appreciate it.
Dude, yeah, man, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Thank you so much for having me on.
Of course. No worries. So that was my episode with Will Beasley, and I thought that he brought up a ton of great points in terms of how to create clarity in your mix and how things like tempo and gain staging and ambience and, you know, the way you use samples in your productions versus reverbs. I think all of that makes a lot of sense, and it was really cool to learn more about how he goes about approaching that kind of stuff in his own productions. And I also thought it was pretty cool to learn more about how he likes to work with ambience in a mix. You know, like I said in the interview, like I felt like I could hear his mixes getting smaller and bigger throughout a track. And it was cool to have him confirm that and talk more about how he likes to use that to make choruses explode. And I think that's a really important underutilized thing that you can definitely do in your mixes. You know, you want your songs to be exciting to people. And one of the easiest ways to do that is through using automation, whether it's automating stereo width, like Will talked about here, or automating things like ambience or volume. Like, all of that stuff can make a major impact to your mix. And so it's important to know what tools you have available to you in order to make the most out of them and make sure that your songs get the treatment that they deserve. So yeah, I really enjoyed that. I hope that you did too. And if you're struggling with your mixes right now, if you're not sure of what to do to make your mixes sound clearer or get your tracks to work with each other, or just to make them sound more exciting overall, like everything we've talked about in this episode, I would love to help you out with that. And inside of my coaching program, Amplitude, I work one-on-one with my students to help you get the answers that you need. So regardless of if you're in the recording, editing, or mixing stage, if you have questions, if you're not sure what steps to be taking, that's exactly what we cover inside of this program. And you get personalized help to make sure that you're taking the right steps. And we listen to your recordings, we listen to your edits and your mixes, and give you the actionable steps needed to get the results that you want. So we actually work with you to figure out, what is it that you want your song to sound like? What other artists do you like? What are you comparing your recordings against? And then we teach you how to get those same results. So inside of this program, like I said, it is very customized to making sure that you are reaching your goals and getting your tracks to sound just as good as you've always wanted to hear them. So if you're interested in learning more about this program, make sure to visit masteryourmix.com/amplitude, and you'll find all of the details of the program there. And then I'd love to hop on a call with you to learn more about your goals and your personal struggles with production right now to see how I can truly help you. And if it seems like you'd be a good fit for this program, then I'll give you all the details about joining and I'll give you a free demo of it as well. And if it doesn't seem like a good fit, no worries. You know, I only want to work with people in this program who I can truly help. So by getting on a call with you, it allows me to figure out if that's possible. And like I said, if it does seem like a good fit, then I'd love to have you join our program. And we have so many amazing people inside of the program already who are just absolutely cranking out songs and getting songs that sound amazing. And it's been such a thrill to see people finally releasing music that they're proud of and songs that sound just the way they've always wanted to hear them. So it's very awesome. And I look forward to working with you inside of that program as well. So once again, if you're interested in learning more, make sure to visit masteryourmix.com/amplitude. So with that said, we've reached the end of this episode. Thank you so much for sticking around, and I can't wait to chat with you in the next one. We'll talk soon.
Thanks for listening to the Master Your Mix podcast. To have your questions answered, submit your questions to questions@masteryourmix.com. Please go to iTunes and subscribe and leave a review. And for more information on how you can improve your mixes, visit masteryourmix.com.